Anybody who knows baseball knows that once in a while, fights break out on the field. Not like in hockey, where the fights are expected, but in baseball, pitches get thrown close, batters get hit, fielders get spiked, and next thing you know, players are throwing punches at one another, the bench is clear, and coaches and umpires try to restore order. One fight in modern baseball history stands apart from the rest. That is the 1965 fight between arch-rival San Francisco Giants and Los Angeles Dodgers. The key moment, Giants pitcher Juan Marichal... featured Giants pitcher Juan Marichal clubbing Dodgers catcher John Roseboro with his bat. Today's guest wrote a book about that called The Fight of Their Lives, how Juan Marichal and John Roseboro turned baseball's ugliest brawl into a story of forgiveness and redemption. The author is John Rosengren. He is the author of three other books about sports and a slew of articles that have appeared in publications ranging from Sports Illustrated to the Utney Reader. He still plays baseball in an adult league and belongs to the Society for American Baseball Research, known by its acronym SABRE. Hi, John.
Good morning. How are you, Jeff?
It's good. Good to have you back on The Exchange. We talked to you about your Hank Greenberg book not very long ago.
Right. It came out a year ago, and now it's out in paperback, but it's nice to be back.
You got those two books out in a hurry. Can we assume you're frequently juggling projects?
I am, although it's a bit of an illusion because I wrote that Greenberg biography and then it took about 18 months to get it published. Or, I mean, the publisher held on to it so it could be released in the spring. And then on this one, the publisher rushed it out about 6 months after I turned the manuscript. So actually, it took about 3 years between the two books.
But the books are generally timed for the spring to make sure that the baseball fever is high?
Exactly, yeah. Publishers like to put out baseball books in the spring when people are thinking baseball. Yeah. And everybody's team is still in contention.
That's right.
Even my twins haven't been mathematically eliminated yet.
I'm sorry I'm laughing. It's just that I actually did look at the standings this morning and thought, hey, the Mets are only three games behind the Braves. This might be the last time this year we'll be able to say that.
Right. Now, right. The percentage, it's pretty far back, but hey, we can dream, right?
There you go with all that saber stuff, you know, the percentages and the numbers and all that. This must be fun, I have to imagine, to go beyond the numbers and to go into depth on people and major events in baseball history, like Hank Greenberg, like this fight.
Well, exactly. That's what I love about baseball. And actually, you know, there are two types of guys in sabers. There are the smart guys who are into the analytics, and then there are guys like me who just love the history and lore of the game. And that's what I look to do in these books is to uncover the history behind important moments or important figures and tell that the full story. And then with Marichal and Roseboro, there was great cultural depth as well as this wonderful tale of the human spirit where they reconciled and forgave each other.
Well, you know, on the basis of the cultural part of things, it occurs to me at this moment there's a certain thematic similarity between this and the Hank Greenberg book. Hank Greenberg was a tremendous home run hitter, but also a Jewish superstar, the first of his kind in Major League Baseball. And, of course, there are racial and cultural things that led up to the Marichal-Roseboro fight.
Exactly. When Greenberg was playing in the 30s and 40s, the anti-Semitism was intense here in the United States. And then when Juan Marichal came to the United States along with the first wave of dark-skinned Latinos after Jackie Robinson, you know, broke down the color barrier. Robinson opened the doors not just for African Americans but also for dark-skinned Latinos, and so Marichal was one of those. And yet, he and his and others like him faced incredible discrimination here in the United States. And as Greenberg, they faced, you know, that the ignorance that discrimination and prejudice is often rooted in. And so, people. Not only did they have to deal with the Jim Crow laws, but they had to, people viewed them as stupid because they didn't speak the language. You know, they came from Spanish-speaking countries, hadn't learned English, and so people viewed them as being stupid in addition to inferior because of the color of their skin. And then, of course, John Roseboro is an African-American, and he has to face all that African-Americans do in the United States. And he'd grown up in Ashland, Ohio, a white, predominantly white community. But he hadn't really known racism until he left and then started encountering it elsewhere, and it was a rude awakening for him.
You know, you pointed out the cultural context, particularly with the Juan Marichal and not speaking English. And when you think about other things that were there in the popular media at the time, this wasn't that long after I Love Lucy and the accent of her husband on the TV show.
Yeah, Ricky Ricardo. Mm-hmm. Desi Arnaz Jr. plays this Cuban. And the American audiences are laughing at his malapropisms. And that was reflected kind of the attitude that Americans had in that day of laughing at those who were different or somehow couldn't function as smoothly in American society, and which was primarily the society run by the dominant white males in the 50s. And it was a time of also cultural superiority, or this attitude of cultural superiority. So the American press was frequently lampooning third world countries, including, you know, the banana republics, like the Dominican Republic, where Marshall came from. So it was those were the sorts of attitudes and prejudices that Marshall came up against when he moved here as a young man.
All right, much more to talk about the book, The Fight of Their Lives, how Juan Marichal and John Roseborough turned baseball's ugliest brawl into a story of forgiveness and redemption. John Rosengren wrote it. He's our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with John. But first, we need to remind you once again, it's the final day of our Spring Fund Drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. All the services together put together a target of $200,000 to raise. We are just short of $141,000 at the moment. So under $60,000 left to raise over the course of a day. The figure sounds a little daunting. It is a little daunting, but the sooner we get people on the phones making those pledges of support, the less daunting it becomes. Please call your pledge in ASAP, 888-552-6191, or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back with John Rosengren and The Fight of Their Lives in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is baseball writer John Rosengren. He's a member of the Society for American Baseball Research, or SABR, and he's written another baseball book, this one about the 1965 fight between the Giants and the Dodgers, the key moment, Juan Marichal taking a bat to the head of John Roseborough. The book is called The Fight of Their Lives, how Juan Marichal and John Roseborough turned baseball's ugliest brawl into a story of forgiveness and redemption. You can join us on The Exchange. Our phone number today, 541-552-6782. Area code 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. You had established already that Juan Marichal is from the Dominican Republic and John Roseborough from Ashland, Ohio. Let's start first with Juan Marichal. How big is baseball in the Dominican Republic?
It's huge, as you can imagine, and as we're beginning to understand with all the great Dominican talent coming and playing in the major leagues right now. But it's the national sport. You know, for many Latin countries, soccer is the big sport, but in the Dominican, baseball rules supreme. And so it was a huge deal. Growing up, Marichal played ball with his buddies, and they all dreamed of playing for the national team. Their dreams didn't quite extend to the United States because, you know, prior to Jackie Robinson, there wasn't that opportunity. But after 1947, his horizons expanded, and then he finally got the chance to come play in the major leagues here.
And what were his general circumstances growing up? Was he didn't have a father that he knew, apparently.
His father died when Juan was 3 years old. He drank too much, and as a result, Juan was not a big drinker himself. But he lived in very humble circumstances, the thatched hut. Thatched roof hut and no indoor plumbing. His mother was a devout Catholic, raised her five children, you know, to be devout themselves, and Juan remained devout throughout his entire adult life.
Which is an interesting thing to think about what a fiery competitor he was. This is not a guy who would take stuff off of anybody, but he sure was apparently quite pious through his life.
Well, he wanted to win as bad as the next guy, but he was, as I said, very devout. He would recite his three favorite psalms every evening before bed. He would go to Sunday Mass. Even when the team was on the road, he'd find a church where he could go to Mass. And he wore a medallion of the Blessed Virgin Mary and would pray to her. So, yeah, he was a very devout guy. And, you know, I don't think the two are incompatible, to be devout and have a strong faith and be competitive.
We had talked already about the fact that he could not. This is a time when you have darker skinned Latinos coming into the major league, so they are already darker than the white players, and that was still a time of racial issues and lingering resentment, certainly in the South, and the issue that they did not speak English. Did Marichal know any English when he first signed up with the major leagues?
You know, he probably knew the words please and thank you, but that was it, or hello. But otherwise, no. You know, he had no opportunity to speak English and no reason to when he was living in the Dominican.
Let us take a call here from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Rosengren. The book is The Fight of Their Lives.
Hi. Oh, I love baseball. I wondered where that saying came from when the guy said, and I don't know who it is, Baseball has been good to me.
I think that was a part of the Garrett Morris joke, baseball being very, very good to me.
Yeah.
Chico Escuela.
Did they got a lot of money, or how does that go?
All right, let's see if there was a real-world comparison for that. Thanks for the call, Jeannie.
Well, I think it's Chico Escuela, baseball been very, very good to me. But that's an example, too, and this is, in the 70s, that
right.
Americans are still laughing at, lampooning the accents and the way that Latinos speak. And, the press did that with people like Roberto Clemente, who they insisted upon calling Bob, or, Marshall or others. They would print phonetic spellings of their malapropisms or mispronunciations of words. And, when you take a step back, it's really such an arrogant, egocentric, disrespectful way of doing things. And I would challenge any of those writers to go down to the Dominican or another Spanish-speaking country and try to function the way these guys were doing it here in the United States.
Right, and when you talk about the phonetic pronunciations, it's like typing out meester as M-E-E-S-T-E-R because that's the way they pronounced it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Aside from any of the cultural stuff, I just want one final thought about Marichal before we move on to John Roseborough. A generation of boys, and believe me, I was among them, imitated Juan Marichal's delivery. What made it unique?
Well, he had that signature high kick where it looked like he was scraping the sky with his cleats, and meanwhile his hand was going all the way down where his knuckles just about touched the ground. And it hid the ball from the batter and was quite intimidating to see first the sole of his shoe and then, follow through with the ball coming at him. Interestingly, he started off as a sidearmer because his hero in the Dominican threw sidearm. But then it was a minor league coach who told him that he could probably have better control if he threw overhand, and he did so and developed that high kick as a way of keeping his balance. And so that's how he got to be have that signature windup. But he continued to throw sidearm and three-quarter speed, so he was three-quarters delivery. So he had five pitches, and he could throw them either overhand, three-quarters or sidearm, and it gave him an arsenal of about 15 pitches, which was very, very effective.
Wow, that's a great arsenal to have. And, of course, there is a statue, as you show us in the book, in the photo section, of Juan Marichal outside the park in San Francisco now with that big high kick, frozen forever in bronze, it would appear. Let's go on to John Roseborough. You mentioned already he was from Ashland, Ohio. Oddly enough, a little similarity with Ashland, Oregon, both of them Klan towns at one time.
Yeah, exactly. Although the Klan had pretty much disappeared from Ashland by the time that Roseborough was born in the 30s, and Ashland built itself as the world headquarters of nice people. No joke, if you go in, drive into Ashland, that's the town the sign that'll greet you as you enter town. And no doubt they are nice people, but because Roseborough was a black kid growing up in this predominantly white town, there's only one or two other black families at the time. People treat him well, but he didn't, he knew his limitations. Like, it was taboo when he became a teenager to date any of the white girls. And so he felt isolated. Like, he didn't feel like he fully fit into the white community, and he also didn't have a black community to fit in with. And so he felt isolated, and he was an introvert, so that complicated it. But as I mentioned, when he left Ashland, that's when he started encountering more of the real serious racism.
Where did he first go? He was stationed a couple places around the minor leagues and actually was taken off to the Army at some point, wasn't he?
Yeah, and even surprisingly in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, which you might think of, being a northern town as being a little more tolerant. Well, they knew the racism there. And back when Jackie Robinson was visiting some people who were hosting him in Sheboygan, somebody had written a racial epithet on the building where this lawyer who was hosting Robinson worked. And so when Roseborough was playing there, some guy yelled at him, used the N-word at him. And it was shocking for Roseborough because he hadn't encountered that. But then, of course, down even in Dodger Town, where the Dodgers trained in Vero Beach, Florida, the taxi drivers wouldn't give Roseborough a ride, or there are certain sections of town where he couldn't go. When his wife came down to watch him play, she couldn't sit with the other players' wives. So it was, Even, you know, we think of the Dodgers as being this progressive team that integrated baseball, but even playing for the Dodgers, Roseboro encountered that sort of racism.
Wow, that's strange. And this is after Jackie Robinson's introduction, too.
Mm-hmm.
John Rosengren, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseboro Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption. You can join our discussion on the Exchange. Our phone number today, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So for the people who don't know the New York end of the story, can you explain the fierce rivalry between the Dodgers and the Giants?
Well, this is perhaps sport's most heated and storied rivalry. It goes all the way back to the 19th century when the Dodgers, who were then known as the Brooklyn Bridegrooms, played an 11-game championship series against the New York Giants, and it was pockmarked with bean balls and bad blood and brawls. And the it's continued. You know, you had the New York Giants, the Brooklyn Dodgers, each representing a different demographic within New York City. And then when the teams moved to the West Coast, people thought, oh, it might cool off a little bit. But because of the natural antipathy between the two host cities, San Francisco and Los Angeles, the rivalry continued unabated. And but when we get to 1965, you've got these two teams with in this tight pennant race amidst the context of their heated, bitter rivalry, and that just fueled the tensions.
We should point out, too, that they were, like in the 1962 season, they ended up tied and ended up having to do a three-game playoff to send the Giants to the World Series, right?
Right, and, you know, it's frequently these two teams in contention for the pennant or vying to knock the other out of contention if they weren't in contention themselves. And there are a couple dramatic times when that happened.
I was thinking about the Joe Morgan home run where they were just so pleased in San Francisco because they hadn't gotten to the playoffs themselves, but at least they knocked the Dodgers out on the final day.
Exactly, which was almost as good as winning the pennant for either team.
It's just amazing how much they get into that rivalry. But so let's talk about the kinds of competitors here. Marichal, as we talked about, was a very fiery competitor, pious man at the same time. But boy, this number, the set of numbers in this incredible game he pitched against Warren Spahn, who was also a huge star at the time for the Milwaukee Braves.
Yeah, absolutely incredible, the number of pitches. He threw over 200 pitches in 16 innings. I mean, think about that. Pitchers today rarely go 9 innings. You know, and, you know, if they get over 100 pitches, the pitching coaches and managers are very careful with their pitch counts and, you know, pull guys out. And Steven Strasburg, the other, the Washington Nationals young pitcher, famously was, you know, held out of the last few games of the season because of they didn't want to have him throw too many pitches in a season. I mean, there was no consideration of that back in Marichal's day. It was considered, unmanly to come out of a game early. You know, guys wanted to finish games. They wanted to throw complete games, and he didn't want to come out of this great game against Spahn, and he kept going and kept going, and like I said, ended up pitching 16 innings and throwing over 200 pitches.
That's crazy. 227 pitches is maybe go, wow, that's more than twice what they will let anybody throw in most games these days.
Right.
John Roseboro, not as fiery a competitor as Marichal, perhaps. How big a clubhouse presence was he?
Roseboro was a quiet guy whom his teammates ironically nicknamed Gabby. I mentioned he was an introvert, but when he did speak up, it was usually something witty or something very pointed. So he wasn't the kind of guy that was, a loud, boisterous guy. He wasn't like Cha-Cha, Orlando Cepeda over in the Giants clubhouse, who was, you know, turning up the music and dancing. But he was very well respected and regarded by his teammates, particularly the pitchers, because he was a really smart catcher and he called a good game. And guys like Sandy Koufax wanted Roseboro as their catcher. He was their top choice. He ran the defense on the field as the catcher. And guys like Jim Murray, writing for the Los Angeles Times, said, you know, that Roseboro was the unsung hero of those championship teams that they had in the early 60s.
So some amazing guys out there with the arms. Sandy Koufax, Don Drysdale. I mean, just a great pitching staff all around. The Giants have Willie Mays still at the time, very much at the peak of his career. Willie McCovey as well. A bunch of big names on that team. Gaylord Perry still pitching at that point.
Right.
Just an amazing set of stuff going on. But then off the baseball field, during this 1965 season in which they're battling each other for supremacy, what's going on in the Dominican Republic, Juan Marichal's home?
Well, you know, the 60s, tumultuous time around the world, and in the Dominican Republic, there was a civil war that had broken out. The United States had committed over 20,000 troops to the cause. And so Juan Marichal is watching these scenes on television of the bloody battles being fought in the streets of Santo Domingo. And he's literally worried sick about his family's safety back home. He's got a sinus infection that's just raging during the course of the 65 season as this civil war continues. And his teammate, Willie Mays, said Juan was so distraught he probably shouldn't have been pitching that summer.
Really? He was that bound up in it? Wow.
Well, and you know, and imagine, too, you're away from home, and both he and his wife had family there, and there was no phone on the farm where Marichal's family lived. And so he'd write a letter and take a week to get there, and then it'd take a week for a letter to get back. So he had to wait 2 weeks. But even from the time they sent the letter, you know, something could have happened. So he was very, very nervous and agitated about the situation at home, very anxious.
And then John Roseborough, of course, an African-American living in Los Angeles, and this is right around the time of the Watts riots.
Exactly, just the week before the Watts riots had gone down, and Roseborough had and his teammates could see from Dodger Stadium the smoke to the south where the buildings were burning in Watts. And Roseborough was wondering, why are we still playing baseball when racial tensions had reached such a fever pitch in the United States? And, you know, like, it was burning in his backyard. And one night, the demonstrators were scheduled to march down the street in front of Roseborough's house. And so he stayed up that night with a loaded gun sitting on his front stoop, ready to protect his family if he needed to. So he was on edge. And, you know, I was just in L.A. yesterday and talking to some people about the Watts riots and what it was like. And, you know, now we look back and we say, well, they lasted 6 days and there was this much property damage and this many people, you know, arrested and these many people injured, et cetera. But at the time, people didn't know how long this was going to last. They didn't know, you know, what the outcome was going to be. And it was still a time of very much anxiety and fear. And Roseborough, you know, as this black man living in the midst of it, was very much on edge himself. And so both these men were personally impacted by the turbulent events of the day, and those came to play, you know, as often happens, and it sounds cliche, but I think it's true. The national pastime reflected what was going on in society.
It really did in a big way. The book is called The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseborough Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption. John Rosengren wrote it. He's our guest on The Exchange. I'm going to ask him to stand by for a couple of minutes. We have so many people to thank with our Spring Fund Drive final day here at JPR. I want to make sure we get a couple of thank yous in before we get to the next break, and also remind you that the phone numbers are 888-552-6191. And you can pledge online as well at ijpr.org. Charlotte Dern, how are we doing?
This is fantastic. We've had so many pledges coming in just during the Jefferson Exchange right now. This is wonderful. Keep those pledges coming in. This is the last day. This is the time to do it. So those of you out there who know that, who have been calling, thank you for that. 888-552-6191 is the number to call. If you have not made your pledge of support yet, a big thank you to Evan Kopold of Eureka and Dennis and Reba Will of Grants Pass for your pledge of support. Another big thank you to Karen Starchvik of Jacksonville. Karen says, I miss West Coast Live, but like the new Sunday lineup.
All right. Also want to thank Skoden in Medford. One name. Keep up the epic work. Skoden says, sorry, I'm late. Hey, you're here. You're on time. That's it. You made the train. Michael Golden and Mary Danka in Ashland, thank you so much. They say thank you, Jefferson Exchange and JPR. Well, you're welcome, and thank you back. Susan Dicegard in Ashland, thanks for your excellent programs and services. She says, keep up the good work. Right back at you. We can only do this if we have support from the people who listen. We can only continue to provide programs like the Jefferson Exchange and all the other offerings across all three services of JPR, news and information, rhythm and news, classics and news, if you, the listener, are also you, the supporter. We are standing just short of $142,000 right now, need to get to $200,000 by 8 o'clock tonight, so about 10 hours remaining now, 10 hours and change, to come in with $58,000 and change. So we can do this. We can do this if there's a constant, steady pressure and a steady drumbeat of calls like the one from Bruce Finch in Days Creek. Patricia and Tom Scudo in Talent, thanks for your pledge. Jean Garanto in Medford, thank you. And Sophia Borges in Ashland, thank you all for your pledges of support. Please make your call as soon as you can, 888 552 6191 or online at ijpr.org.
Yes, lots of volunteers here waiting to take your pledges of support. Wayne Delt in Talent, thank you for your pledge of support. Donna Healy of Gold Hill for your pledge. And Ellen and Douglas Faulkner of Ashland for your pledge of support. Keep those pledges coming. This is the last day. Make that pledge now. 888-552-6191 or at ijpr.org. We'll head back into the Jefferson Exchange right after the short break.
And I missed the chance to put up one of these challenges because one of our callers is a frequent caller of the Jefferson Exchange. She challenges the other frequent callers to pledge as well. We want to hear from you. 888-552-6191, ijpr.org. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is baseball writer John Rosengren. His latest book, oddly enough, timed for release just in time for baseball season, is called The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseboro Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to reset the stage here, it's August of 1965. The Watts riots have just taken place. There's an ongoing civil war in the Dominican Republic where Juan Marichal is from. John Roseboro lives close to Watts in Los Angeles. They could see smoke from the riots at Dodger Stadium. Was there much discussion that you're aware of in either clubhouse about the circumstances in either place, John Rosengren?
You know, I think Juan played with the Alou brothers, and they were good friends, and they were both, they did talk about what was going on in their families, and would, if either one of them got word from someone who'd been down there about what was going on, they would let the other know. And so they were certainly talking about it. Meanwhile, the African-American players, especially in the Dodger clubhouse, were concerned and talking about what was going on, and Roseboro even had hired a bus to get some of the kids out of Watts to come to the Dodger games during that time. So there was talk about it concern among both groups.
You talked about how baseball can mirror the circumstances that are going on in society. There were some other incidents in baseball that year, weren't there, that indicated that things had gotten a bit nastier between teams or even between players on the same team?
Well, there were, and things like Sandy Koufax had hit Lou Brock. He was famous for not throwing at people, though he would when the situation called for it. And he, Lou Brock of the Cardinals had shown him up, and he threw at Brock, hit him in the ribs. Don Drysdale had thrown it at Mets players, and Marshall had complained bitterly about that to the press and kind of sent a warning to Drysdale. And Drysdale retaliated and said, "Listen, I'm right here. Come get me if you want me to." And so, that there was bad blood there between the Giants and the Dodgers, and specifically Marshall. And then there was an incident on the Phillies where Dick Allen and Frank Thomas, Allen a black player, Thomas a white player, got in an argument, and Thomas hit Allen with his bat in the shoulder. And yet, interestingly, I think because Allen was a Maverick and African-American, Allen was the one who got blamed for it, even though he was the one who got hit with the bat, though the Phillies did trade Thomas shortly afterward.
Huh. I'd never heard that story before. I knew that but Richie Allen was certainly, and we called him Richie then before we called him Dick Allen.
But you know what? He was another guy who, and I just learned this at an academic baseball conference where a guy gave a presentation on Allen. He said he always went by Dick, but the press called him Richie.
Really? Or
like the press was calling Clemente Bob
instead
of Roberto. And it was another one of those times, I think, of the press kind of coming up with their own identity for a guy and not really respecting who he was or what his wishes were.
All right, so we have all this stuff that's going on the field, or at least near the field. We have the stuff going on off the field, the Giants and Dodgers, terrible rivals in the best of years, and both trying to vie for the pennant in August of 1965. Now, help out the non-baseball fans. There is this unwritten code about pitchers throwing deliberately at guys on the other team. I mean, what's the circumstance usually?
So the code is, if a guy, say, from the Giants throws at a Dodger batter, then when the Giants star comes to the plate, the Dodger pitcher will throw at the Giant batter to kind of, say, listen, in effect, protecting his players or sending the message, you can't pick on our guys without there being retaliation. And so it's sort of a way of keeping an equilibrium there on the field. And so that's baseball's code.
All right. So what was the circumstance that led to the big moment in the fight of their lives?
Well, you know, it's this tight pennant race late in the summer of '65. There's a critical four-game series being played in San Francisco between the Dodgers and Giants, and this is the fourth game of that four-game series. There's been some drawing back and forth already, including between Marshall and Roseboro. Well, in that fourth game, on Sunday afternoon, marquee matchup between Juan Marshall and Sandy Koufax, Marshall has thrown at two Dodger batters, knocked them down. He didn't hit them, but he, you know, threw so close they had to jump out of the way. Koufax has thrown an inside pitch over the head of Willie Mays, and so the umpire, the home plate umpire, has warned both teams, no more knockdown pitches or I'll eject the pitcher. So when Marshall comes to bat in the bottom of the third, baseball's code would call for Koufax to throw at Marshall, but because of the warning from the home plate umpire, John Roseboro tells Koufax, listen, I'll take care of it. So Roseboro, the catcher, deliberately drops the ball, throws it back right past Marshall's face. Marshall said it came so close it nicked his ear. And think about that for a minute. If you're the batter, you're standing in the batter's box, you're looking out at the pitcher, and suddenly this ball comes whizzing by your head from 3 feet behind you. I mean, it startled and shocked Marshall. It scared him. He could have been killed, you know, if the ball had hit him directly. He's angry. So he turns to confront Roseboro, and then he sees Roseboro, a catcher, coming out of his crouch in his full catcher's gear. And he maybe has some threats that Roseboro's issued earlier echoing in his mind. And so he takes a step back and brings the bat down on Roseboro's head. And, you know, not to justify what Marshall did, he would, you know, be the first to say that it was wrong, and he immediately felt guilty. But I think it helps us understand why he behaved as he did in that moment when he was, you know, afraid and stunned and startled and angry.
I still have never seen motion images of this. I mean, did he really just wind up with the bat? I mean, he did cause a cut over Roseboro's eye. And, of course, at the time, there was so much blood, there was concern he actually kind of knocked out Roseboro's eye.
Right. There were four cameras. The Channel 11 in Los Angeles was filming the game, and they had four cameras there. The camera trained on home plate had actually moved back to the pitcher's mound, which was standard at the time. You know, after the ball goes back to the pitcher, they focus on the pitcher on the mound with the ball. So there's no video, and of course there was nobody in the stands taking cell phone video.
Right.
And so the only video that exists that I've seen is right after that clubbing, where the two, Roseboro and Marshall, have moved out into the grass in front of home plate, and Koufax rushes in off the mound. But you're right that the bat, I think Roseboro's mask must have deflected some of the blow, because it didn't, you know, it could have killed him too, the way Marshall hit him in the head with a bat. But it opened this 2-inch gash, and the blood that came down covering Roseboro's eye made people like Willie Mays on the field think that Roseboro's eye had been knocked out. And, you know, they thought the injury was much worse than it was. As it was, it required 14 stitches to close that 2-inch gap wound. But it and Roseboro had a slight concussion, but, you know, it could have been much, much worse.
You know, this is the part where I came to the story years ago. I was reading a book about, I think it was an elementary school book about great baseball players, and it was about Willie Mays' intervention in this. He really came to Roseboro's aid, even though he's on the other team, right?
Right. The two were actually friends, though, you know, often that friendship stopped at when they stepped onto the baseball field. But in this instance, Roseboro was bleeding. He was obviously injured, and yet he was angry, and he was going after Marshall, and Mays pulled him, and he said, Johnny, your eye is out. Come, stop. And he brought him over to the trainer and allowed the trainer to, you know, try to staunch the bleeding with a towel. Well, as Roseboro was standing there getting tended to, he realized he was still angry, and he went back and, you know, jumped back into the fracas and went after Marshall another time. And this time a coach, Preston Gomez, pulled him out. But I think Mays and some of the others trying to break this up were concerned that, you know, in the context of the Watts riots and other violent episodes in American history of late, they were afraid the fans would come onto the field and, you know, cause a full bloody riot. And so that's one of the things motivating Mays to try to break it up and act as the peacemaker.
So what did happen to Juan Marichal from this? Was he ejected, suspended, fined? I mean, what was the punishment?
He was ejected from the game, and then the National League president fined him $1,750, which doesn't seem like a lot in today, but at the time it was the largest fine ever issued by Major League Baseball against a player. And they also suspended him 8 playing dates, plus the 2-game series that the Giants played in Los Angeles about a week later, or 2 weeks later. Warren Giles, the president of National League, was afraid that if Marshall was down there in L.A., you know, another riot or brawl could break out. So he ended up missing 3, maybe 4 starts as a result of the suspension, and the Giants lost the pennant, I think as a result of the fact that when Marshall came back, he wasn't the same effective pitcher he'd been prior to the fight. So Giants lost the pennant, and Dodgers won it and won the World Series. But there was
over your Twins, I should point out.
Yeah, you had to bring that up, didn't you?
Sorry. Had to be said.
That was an amazing. Sandy Koufax actually pitched a great series, coming back to pitch game 7 on 2 days rest. So the Dodgers did deserve the win. But anyway, there was an initial consequence for Marshall. He ended up being castigated, you know, as this villain because of that iconic photograph, I think, that many have seen with him wielding the bat. And he, you know, as I mentioned, being this devout Catholic, he felt immediately guilty, and he issued a public apology, but people still held it against him. And he deserved to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but when his time came, the baseball writers still held this incident against him and didn't elect him in the first year. Second year, he still didn't get elected. So that's when he finally called up John Roseboro, and he said, "Johnny, I need your help." And Roseboro, I think, had carried his own guilt about the incident because he had let Juan take all the blame. Mm-hmm. That photograph sort of shows Juan is the villain, Roseboro is the victim.
And right.
He'd embrace that role. He'd sued Marshall for provoking the incident. He said Marshall's punishment should be 10 minutes in a room alone with me. And later, about 15 years later, he published his autobiography. And in it, he did admit provoking the incident by throwing the ball back past Marshall's face. But when Juan called John and asked for his help, I think John was willing to help him because it was a way of relieving his own guilt. So Roseboro agreed to go play in a golf tournament that Juan hosted in the Dominican. They had a press conference and posed for photos, and they told the sports writers, "Listen, you should really put this behind you. We've done that, and you've made too much of it already, so let's let it, you know, lay in the past." And so as a result, Marshall did get in the next year to the Hall of Fame, and one of the people he called was Roseboro, and he said, "Johnny, I'm in. Thank you. Thank you." And he broke down and cried, and Roseboro cried too, and it was the beginning of this wonderful friendship between the two of them.
That's a great story, and well told in the book, The Fight of Their Lives, how Juan Marichal and John Roseboro turned baseball's ugliest brawl into a story of forgiveness and redemption. John Rosengren wrote it. He's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. John, thanks. Good to have you back on the Exchange.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. And may I just make a plug for public radio? Because
sure.
I'm a member here in Minnesota where I live, and I think it's a great asset to the community. And, you know, it's a chance to – it gives – you know, I get my news from All Things Considered and the local public radio station, and I just think it's a great asset for us to have here in the community. You know, so I hope your listeners will support it.
All right. We did not put you up to this. You came up with this. You said,
"No, that's completely on my own."
Great. John, thanks so much. Again, good to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.